From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Like Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, an effort to screen all Milwaukee's children for physical and mental development issues. Later, Melinda Myers helps us get our lawns through a cool, wet spring. Plus, what kind of flowers should you get for mom this weekend?
So mix it up. Yeah, everybody loves mixed bouquets. I mean, women do more than what men think they want, which is a dozen roses.
And writer Abby Callard gets up close and personal with roller derby.
You know, when you're sitting up on the stands and you see a hit, that's one thing. But to see it sort of when you're, you know, on the same level and 5 feet away and actually hear everything that's happening is, it seems a lot more violent.
Lake Effect comes your way next after news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. When you're the parent of a small child, there are certain milestones in their physical and mental development you tend to look out for. But beyond the obvious ones, things like walking and talking are some more subtle markers of a child's development. And those milestones are not always reached when they should be. And in many cases in the city of Milwaukee, no one is paying attention until it's too late. But a federally supported program called Project Launch has been underway for several years in Milwaukee. It seeks to standardize the effort to track childhood development and empower more caregivers to carry out that screening. It's targeted on 12 specific zip codes and funded through a grant from the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Cindy Muhar is a family living educator with the Milwaukee County UW Cooperative Extension. Dr. Ariana Kyle is the program coordinator for the Wisconsin Statewide Medical Home Initiative through Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Muhar is with us in the studio. Kyle joins us on the line from Madison. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For asking us.
So what is happening, or what had been happening, particularly in 12 zip codes in Milwaukee, but perhaps on a broader scale, that necessitated the undertaking that Project Launch represents?
Well, there are disparities in healthy birth outcomes and infant mortality rates in those zip code areas, Mitch.
What is at stake here? What happens if this effort and others potentially like it isn't a success? What happens if we go another generation with these routine screenings not being as universal as they could be?
Well, I can tell you at this point, only 30% of all children with developmental delays are diagnosed before they get to kindergarten. And research has shown the importance of early detection and early intervention, again, to help these children reach their full potential. So if we don't start doing universal screening, these children are going to continue to fall through the net, so to speak, until they get to school. And at that point, then they'll have either a lot of catching up to do or it just is really, they don't have as good of outcomes had they been discovered earlier and gotten the support they needed at a very early age.
How successful has Project Launch been? I mean, what can you tell us about the progress that's been made so far?
Well, I can tell you that we are trying to address universal screening in several ways. One way is we are providing training to child care providers so that they can be offering the tool to parents, because that's a really important part about this, Mitch, is that it's a parent-administered tool. The tool recognizes parents as the experts about their children. So the child care providers will work in partnership with parents to provide the screening, share results, and then make appropriate referrals. So one of the things we're doing is providing training for early childhood educators, child care providers, pediatricians. And then another thing that we're doing is we are training trainers to provide training of the ASQ. YoungStar, which is the quality assurance arm of the state for child care providers, recognizes the ASQ as a valid tool and is recommending or approves its use for family providers. And so in order to be a YoungStar trainer, you have to be a registry-approved trainer. And so we started a little over a year ago, as far as I know, I was the only registry-approved ASQ trainer in the city of Milwaukee. And by the end of the year, there will be 8 of us. And after that, there should be 10 to 12 within the next year. So that will help build capacity to keep people's minds focused on this tool and how to use it and keep it at the forefront in our community.
Well, and so as a trainer, what is that process like? Talk about what you do when you sit down and try to educate someone about ASQ.
Okay, one of the first things we do is we talk about the process itself, how long it's going to take, because it can take up to a year. We talk about what's required in the process, and then I make sure that people are still really interested in it. I provide them with an ages and stages kit, and then they come and attend a full-day training, so they get to know about the tool. And then they are required to assist parents, do 5 different screenings to score the tool, to share those results with the parents and make appropriate referrals as necessary. And I act as their coach in that regard. And then after they've done the 5 screenings, we meet and talk again. We talk about any challenges they may have faced, some of the strengths, any aha moments. And then from there, they can watch a video on a home visitor doing an ASQ. And then we do a co-facilitation. So we work together to provide a full-day training for child care providers or early childhood educators. And then I provide feedback after the training. And then we meet again to review PowerPoint even further. And then they co-facilitate a workshop on their own. So, again, it can take anywhere from 6 months to a year, depending on what our schedules are like and how often we can get workshops scheduled.
Well, and so where do the parents enter the equation?
They're the ones that administer the tool. They're the ones that go through the questionnaire, answer all the questions, and then they bring the tool back to the provider, and the provider scores the tool, and then they prepare a written summary for the parents with recommendations. The parents also, with the child care providers, they will work with the child care provider to develop goals for the provider's lessons plans for the child. So the parents are very integral in the application of this tool.
Ariana, we were talking about successes or progress that the project has made since project launched. What have been the chief challenges along the way?
Well, you know, I think when we're looking at supporting professionals in those 12 target zip code areas, these are people who are really serving high needs children and families on a daily basis. And I think they have a number of competing priorities for their time and their energy. And so sometimes it can be a challenge to recruit people to participate in these trainings. And we've been fortunate to support 5 different pediatric and family practice clinics within those 12 target zip codes, training over 50 clinicians and their care team members. But of course, we would always appreciate the opportunity to share the information with more. We have a 5-year period of time from the start of the project launch grant in 2009 to when it ends in 2014. We'd really like to just make people aware on an ongoing basis that these resources are available and support is available to help them use standardized tools within their practice.
What is the ultimate aim by 2014, by the time this grant runs out?
You know, I think there are a variety of aims. You know, I think in terms of developmental screening, certainly one primary goal is to ensure that more professionals are using a standardized tool, specifically the Ages and Stages questionnaire, and with different professional sectors using the same tool. So, for instance, Cindy is training child care providers to use the ASQ, and our grant is training pediatricians and family physicians to use the same tool. And by those 2 professional sectors using the same tool, it can really help facilitate communication and really help to streamline care for children and families. So I think one significant goal of Project Launch is to increase the number of professionals who are using the ASQ routinely and therefore having more children's development screened on a routine basis.
These 12 zip codes we're talking about, I imagine these are the zip codes, the areas of the greatest health disparities?
Correct.
Are there challenges in, you know, you talk about where the parents come in. is that they need to be using this tool. You can train all the child care providers and all the pediatricians and all the other professionals you want, but there needs to be cooperation on the part of the parents. Have there been issues in getting the parents to not necessarily buy in, but to take part?
No, I think some of the challenges are, as Ariana had indicated earlier, these are zip code areas where there are lots of challenges for families. And so management of time and priorities is really important. But once the parent sees the tool, they get really engaged in the tool. We've done some focus groups with parents who have used the tool, and they really enjoy the tool. In fact, when home visitors use it in their programs, they often get parents asking, when can we do that again? Because it's a lot of fun. It helps them to understand childhood development even a little better. It helps them play with their child and understand their child's strengths. So it's really a fun tool. One of the other things is not every child is in child care. So there's another way that parents can do the screening on their own without partnership of a provider or pediatrician. The Easter Seals is providing this available online for free to parents under their Make the First Five Count initiative. So parents can go to their website and they can complete the online screening all by themselves, and they will get feedback from Easter Seals as to how their child is developing and any appropriate referrals that they'd need to make.
Ariana, or Cindy for that matter, can you give us some samples of the kinds of questions that show up as part of this tool? What are the kinds of things that when parents are sitting down to try to assess how their child is developing, they have to answer?
Well, Cindy, do you have an age interval questionnaire with you there? There are 21 different age interval questionnaires with the Ages and Stages Questionnaire Toolkit. They screen kids as young as 2 months of age, all the way up to 5 years of age.
You don't have to go. You don't have to go through all of them. Just a sample, though, would be interesting.
Sure. First of all, the answers for parents are either yes, sometimes, or not yet. And that's a beautiful thing about the tool, is that it's very strength based. If the answer's not yet, it just means let's look for this behavior, this skill to be developed in the near future. So one of the questions might be for an 18-month-old. When your baby looks in the mirror and you ask your baby, where is Bobby? Does the baby point to himself in the mirror? Okay, that's one question. For infants, they may ask, does your baby grab a hold of your finger and hold on very tightly? So they're very simple questions. And again, these are questions that parents are going to know about their children because they are the experts. So that's one reason parents like filling it out. Another great thing is that it's written at a low literacy level. So most parents can read it and understand it with no problem at all.
What about follow-through? A child care provider gives this tool to a parent. A parent fills it out. The child care provider is able to score it and say, well, you know, these are the things that perhaps are areas of concern. What happens then?
Well, then they would make a referral. And we've been working closely with our Birth to Three coordinator in Milwaukee County to create a referral packet that we can provide to providers, people who are being trained, so they can better understand the referral process and feel comfortable with it and kind of hold the parent's hand through the referral process. I think that's a really important thing. So if a child is an infant up to age 3, we could make a referral to Birth to Three for diagnostic assessment. If the child is older than 3 years old, we'd make a referral to Child Find through the Milwaukee Public Schools. And sometimes they don't need a formal referral. Sometimes it would be an informal referral, like perhaps a suggestion for a child to become a member of a particular play group or something else that can help strengthen their development.
From the medical provider end, if a child does have a concerning screening result on the Ages and Stages questionnaire or any other validated screening instrument, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that that child receive 3 simultaneous referrals. So the first is to early intervention, like Cindy mentioned, if the child is between 0 and 3 years of age, or to early childhood special education if the child is between 3 and 5 years of age. The second two referrals that the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends for these children are for a full medical evaluation to determine if there's a physical cause behind the delay. And AAP says that child's primary care clinician is really ideally positioned to conduct that evaluation. And then the last evaluation AAP recommends for children with concerning screening results is a full developmental evaluation, really to determine if there is a specific diagnosis behind the delay that could help guide treatment.
Do the two of you feel like this is already making a difference, or is the result really not going to be known for 2, 3, 5, 10 years?
I believe it's already making a difference. We trained over 200 early childhood educators last year alone, and they are implementing the tool in their organizations. So we're going to be doing a follow-up evaluation survey of those providers to find out how things are going. So I think right now it is making a difference.
From the aspect of medical providers' use of validated screening instruments, we've really seen a nice uptake over the past 6 years when these trainings have been offered to clinicians and their care team members. The efforts started out prior to Project Launch, but really have been supplemented by Project Launch. So we've seen a really nice uptake in use of validated tools by pediatricians and family physicians. And I think increasingly, as the word gets out, as different professional sectors are using the tools, as parents are exposed to these tools or see neighbors who are using the tools with their children, I think it doesn't take very much for people to really get engaged in the process and to realize how helpful an instrument like the ASQ can be, not only in identifying those children with delays as early as possible, but also for typically developing children, to really heighten their parents' appreciation for typical development and give them a sense for developmental skills that may be coming in the near future.
Ariana Kyle, Cindy Muhar, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
My pleasure.
Cindy Muhar is a family living educator with the Milwaukee County UW Cooperative Extension. Dr. Ariana Kyle is the program coordinator for the Wisconsin Statewide Medical Home Initiative through Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Both groups are stakeholders in a childhood wellness screening program called Project Launch, which is scheduled to run through next year. You can learn more from links at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a quick break now, but keep listening. Gardening contributor Melinda Myers joins us with advice on this challenging spring for our plants. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. So it felt like spring for a while there, didn't it? Our run of nice warm weather was a welcome one, especially on the heels of what had been a very cool, wet start to the season. The gardeners among us may have been tempted by the reprieve and the deluge to go out and get some planting and pruning done, but was that a wise move? And what has this soggy season meant to our lawns? Lake Effect contributor Melinda Myers is going to take off her hip waders for a few minutes to give us a sense for what's going on in our yards. Welcome back to the show.
Always great to be here, Mitch.
I know I've asked this question before, but given the way things have gone this spring, I think it bears asking again. Do our plants care how warm it is as long as it's above freezing and they're getting enough water and light?
You know, that's a great question. Some plants are very temperature sensitive. So things like tomatoes and peppers really need not only warm air, but warm soil. So the late spring, all the moisture, especially those gardening in clay soil, are going to need to wait. Traditionally, Memorial Day is planting day. It may be early June, or we may just want to give them a little extra TLC, maybe cover them with a floating row cover, that type of thing. But there are plants like pansies and broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower that like it cool and tolerate our cool soil. So actually, the cool spring will be better for things like peas and those. The flavor's better. They really grow much better. So it's about matching the plant to the growing conditions, not only soil type and sunlight, but also temperature.
And this is why also I gather that the daffodils and the tulips were happy to come up regardless of the fact that it was 45 degrees and raining.
You bet. And you notice they were a little bit later than last year, which was an unusually warm season, and about the same as the year before. So temperature will influence when they come up, but you're right. They like the cooler temperatures. The blooms last longer as well. So as long as we don't get a cold snap, on the flower buds, they can take those cooler temperatures. In fact, I've seen plants like crocus and glory of the snow under a foot of snow for about a week. They came out beautifully. The snow was a great mulch. The temperatures were 15 going into the snowfall. Those were more frost tolerant than some of the other plants we grow.
That's good news for our friends in Minnesota who had the foot and a half of snow. Well, so as far as specific plants go, I want to start with the lawn, actually. It seemed a little like adding insult to injury that after this cool, wet spring, all of a sudden we were out there cutting the grass. What sort of impact has this spring had on grass and lawns?
You know, we've gotten a lot of rain. Unfortunately, it didn't come last summer when we needed it, but it is recharging our groundwater. So that's a good thing. The cool temperature's excellent for grass, delaying a bit of germination. And that means if you've seeded your lawn a little earlier than you should have or did some dormant seeding, things are just starting to come up. So now is a great time to be overseeding, seeding those bare spots. And unfortunately, some people are redoing their lawn totally after last year's drought. So the cooler temperatures and that moisture, great for the rain, and you're bad for the mowing, but good for the rain. So this is a good time. Now, if you are seeding your lawn, do not use a crabgrass pre-emergent because that'll kill the grass seed too. So you'll have spent a lot of money and time and end up with the same bare spot. So decide, do I need to overseed and I'll deal with crabgrass next year, or do I need to deal with crabgrass? So if your lawn is pretty thin and bare, I'd go with seeding.
I know in the heat of the summer, you recommend raising the blade on the lawnmower a bit. Is the reverse the case during these conditions? Should we be cutting grass way back?
You know, you would think that would help extend the time between mowing, but it doesn't. So growing your grass longer is excellent because it encourages good deep root growth, and you'll have a healthier, more pest and weed resistant grass. And you're going to be cutting it the same amount of time if you mow properly, and that's removing no more than a third of the total top growth. Cutting more than that is stressful, and we all have to do it at times because we're out of town, run out of time, and so we harvest our lawn, I call it. Chop those clippings up if you don't have a mulching mower and leave them on the lawn. But try to get out there as often as possible and remove no more than 1 inch total, about a third of the total height.
Let's say you're not seeding at this stage of the game, but you're still dealing with some health issues. What at this stage of the growing season should we be doing about things like crabgrass and creeping Charlie and all that stuff?
The weeds did great last year. Somebody once asked me, what's with that? The weeds do great, the plants don't, and that's why they're weeds, because they tolerate those tough conditions. If you want to go a little more eco-friendly, the good news is there are products. There's corn gluten meal that they found that if you do a spring and fall application after 3 years, you can reduce your weeds by 80%. Now, it doesn't kill the existing weeds. It prevents germination. And so we want to apply that when we apply regular traditional crabgrass pre-emergence when the Van Hoot or Bridal Respiree are blooming. And those are the ones with the long white arching branches. We used to say the forsythia are blooming. They're blooming right now for most of us. So start getting ready, because when you see the lilac flower buds swell or those Bridal Respiree bloom, you want to make sure you get the crabgrass pre-emergent down. The other thing is there's some good broadleaf weed killers on the market that are more eco-friendly. They use a formulation of chelated iron called Heta or Faheta, and that's the active ingredient. And Whitney Farms is one of the brands. There are a couple of different ones, but that's the one I'm finding most readily available. And you can spot treat. And I've used it on Creeping Charlie when it's in full bloom, turn the weed black. And if it gets on the grass around it, that just gets dark green from the iron. So it's toxicity from iron. Broadleaf's more susceptible. Iron grass tolerates the iron. Or broadleaf weed killers, when Creeping Charlie's in bloom, is the time to treat. And the same with the other broadleaf weeds. Mid-spring is a good time. Late summer, early fall, even late fall after a hard freeze is another good time. So beef up the grass, spot treat your weeds, even if you use natural products to reduce the chemical. And fertilize Memorial Day, Labor Day weekend with a slow-release, low-nitrogen fertilizer, something like a Milorganite.
I was surprised that mushrooms have not really been much of a problem yet in my yard, despite how wet and cool it has been. But given the conditions, should they be a concern?
You know, I think the cool temperatures may be slowing things down. You're absolutely right, though. You'd expect to see an explosion of mushrooms. Mushrooms are the fruiting bodies on soil-borne fungi that decay wood, so old tree roots, which there should be plenty of dead tree roots out there after the drought, you know, any construction material or wood. So I think as the temperatures warm and if we do continue to have some moist conditions, fungi like cool, moist conditions. So maybe we lost a few of the spores over the summer last year. There's got to be something good, right, from that drought.
Well, let's talk about, and you touched on this a bit, but in terms of the rest of our landscape, while the temperature has been above freezing, it has really only been in the last few days that we've been able to go out and enjoy it and get into our yards. Has the weather impacted the growing season at all, or have we missed any of our window? I mean, you said it has really been too soon to put in tomatoes. Are we at a risk for not getting them in time?
You know, it's been a good reminder for people that like to jumpstart the season a little early without added seasonal protection. So really, traditionally, warm season plants go in Memorial Day the first week in June. So we're good. The rain really delayed and the cold delayed getting some of those cool crops like broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage. So if we get them in the ground now, great time to plant, and it gets really hot in June, the flavor isn't as good. Peas the same way. We usually plant peas early. We like to get them harvested before it gets too hot. One of the things I like about growing in containers is I can start when it's convenient for me, take the plants out on warm days, bring them in, or I like to cheat the system. And I use floating row covers, Remay, Harvest Guard, Frost Blanket, Grass Fast. So it covers the plants or your containers even, lets air, light, and water through, but traps the heat, protecting them down to 24 degrees. And the real clincher, too, is when we go to the garden center and buy plants, we want to ask, have they hardened them off? If those plants are sitting outside and we know that they're outside and they're getting used to the elements, they're ready to go in the garden. If you're buying it inside the Quonset hut, the greenhouse, you're going to have to gradually introduce it. Those banana plants that are in that nice warm environment aren't going to take to being outside in 40 degrees right away. So over a couple of weeks, gradually introduce them to a little more light, the cooler temperatures, and a little bit drier conditions. You're going to water well, but not quite the same humidity as in the greenhouse.
The other thing that all the rain brought into sharp relief was issues surrounding erosion. And I'm wondering if you have thoughts for people. It's obviously too late to protect our yards from erosion problems that have already happened. But what about erosion in the future should we be doing?
One thing we can, if we learn from weather, and I always say being an older gardener is a good thing, not the knees and backs. But the seasons you go through and the longer you garden in your yard or your landscape or your community, you get a better handle on things like erosion. So you're right. You can't undo what's done in terms of stopping what happened, but we can fix it and then look for ways to stop it. So if you had a lot of erosion, do you need ground covers in that area that will protect the soil? Do you need to put your plantings in raised beds and more water-tolerant plants around that? Do you need to work with your neighbors and look at how the drainage patterns are happening, especially away from the foundation of your house? You know, grading away is one of the best ways to keep water out of your basement. So you're absolutely right. Take advantage of this. Look for plants that tolerate those wet, soggy areas, plants to hold the soil intact, and other strategies. You know, it may be leveling that slope to be a little more gentle, and that's all it takes.
Melinda Myers, thanks.
Thank you, Mitch.
Melinda Myers is author of numerous books, including Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin. She's also host of Melinda's Garden Moments on television, and she is a regular Lake Effect contributor. You can learn more about her upcoming series of garden walks at Berner Botanical Gardens from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And an addendum to our conversation about mushrooms: within hours of recording our interview, the mushrooms made their first appearance in my yard. How about yours? Share your garden news or questions for a future segment by stopping by the Lake Effect page on Facebook or tweet us. We are at WUWM Lake Effect on Twitter. While some of the flowers in our yards and along our boulevards may be blooming already, a lot of the flowers this weekend will be of the store-bought variety. Ahead of Mother's Day, we'll talk about the significance of certain flowers when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Floriography is the language of flowers. Blossoms can have multiple or varied meanings, but some represent prevalent customs. For her wedding, Kate Middleton continued the royal tradition of carrying myrtle in her bridal bouquet. That flower stands for love and marriage. White lilies symbolize purity at Easter. Buttercups might butter up one's boss for a raise. They mean riches. Ahead of Mother's Day, Milwaukee School of Flower Design founder Michael Gaffney stopped by the Lake Effect studio. He shared hints on how kids and dads can pick up a meaningful bouquet for mom. First, he told Lake Effect's Amy Kiley the history of flower meanings.
Flowers came to have meaning many, many, many years ago, medieval times. It started then, and it actually really became important in Victorian times, from what I understand, is that flowers were, in medieval times, actually were used to cover bodily odors. That's why they were called nosegays.
Oh.
And men wore them and carried them as much as women to mask unwanted odors. And then in Victorian times, they developed not only better hygiene and soaps and powders and perfumes, but also to express their sentiments. So in those times, you weren't quite as flirtatious as we are these days. And you would hand bouquets to the person you were interested in. And oftentimes, most of the times, based on what the meaning of the flowers was, conveyed your message or intent to that lover you were hoping to attract. I've read that in typical Victorian times, it would be up to 12 different, you know, these overzealous guys, like, you know, how single men are, they would have 12 different flowers in these bouquets to say, I'm bashful, I'm shy, you're beautiful, I love you, I want to marry you, I'm not quite sure, I'm whatever.
For listeners shopping for Mother's Day this weekend, what are some flowers that have positive meanings for mom?
Again, in the old days, they had lots of garden varieties, which aren't even available or they're renamed. So, you know, there's a whole history of all that stuff. But in contemporary times, we usually deal with what's commercially available. For example, I just want to give you a funny one. Alstroemeria. Do you know what Alstroemeria is? It's a real grocery store flower, they call it. It's the least expensive one you could buy. It lasts forever. And people say, oh, I don't like it. Michael, I don't want any of that in my bouquets. It's very cheap, grocery store. Yet, Alstroemeria stands for wealth, prosperity, and fortune. Flowers for mothers, let's say, if you've got a traditional mother, carnations, again, considered low-end, don't give me carnations, America's most hated flower, which is, by the way, the hottest flower in New York right now. But carnations mean love of a mother, love of your mother. So there's no better flower you could give, especially pink ones. Typical other flowers in spring, daisy, cheerfulness, your mother, thoughtfulness, freesia, F-R-E-S-I-A, it's a small, delicate blossom, gardenias, purity. Your mother's love is pure, most, you know, sweet. Sweetness and purity is gardenia. So many different flowers. You could put a bouquet together, and I think it'd be a great thing to have a little card adding why you chose the flowers you did. I'm trying to think of what flowers people love lately. Hydrangeas, America's hottest flower. Everybody wants hydrangeas. They stand for heartfelt emotions. So that would be another good flower to give to your mother. If your mother's a little bit more of a free spirit, orchids have always symbolized exotic. A little on the wild side. And it also stands for proud of femininity. So
proud and feminine or
proud of your femininity.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Very modern.
Yeah, it's interesting because not a lot of guys give orchids.
And that's actually my next question, too. If dads are buying for Mother's Day, how can they make the bouquet a little bit more romantic?
How can they make it romantic? Here's what everybody thinks they want. I've been doing this for many years, and I see guys lined up at the counter, and they say, I'll take a dozen roses, please. And I go, she doesn't want that. And they're like, really? I go, no. What does she want? She wants two of everything in my store. All right. You can't want two of everything. But what she wants, if you want to make it more romantic, I'm telling you, I just did a television show here, and I said, which one do you want? It was three dozen roses arranged or a mixed European bouquet, which means you have some lilies, some tulips, a few irises, some beautiful filler flowers like heather, which stands for sincerity. You make this big European English garden blend, and it's what women love. And so I was on a TV show the other day, and the one woman was very single and very young and very blonde, and she grabbed the three dozen roses. And the other mother, and I said, I didn't even know them at all. And the other one grabbed, oh, I want the other one. And I said, I'm going to tell you right now, you're married with children. You are not. And they're both the same age. And they said, you're right. How did you know? I said, I know by the flowers you chose. Because you would kill your husband if he came home with three dozen roses. And yet you are flattered if a guy would give you, you know, because it's being single. So you want to have the most effect on a bouquet on Mother's Day. Find a good florist. Tell them you want a mixed European bouquet. And have them hand select a variety of flowers and just make it into a lovely hand tie. She can drop in a vase. You don't need anything. It's like telling her who you'd marry her all over again.
What do the flowers in it mean then?
They mean all the good things. Amaryllis means splendid beauty. Carnations, of course, love of a mother. Daisies, cheerfulness. What else could you put in there? Hyacinths, playfulness. If your mother's fun. Lilacs, youthful, innocence. Tell her she's still young and beautiful. Roses, of course, love. So mix it up. Yeah, everybody loves mixed bouquets. I mean, women do more than what men think they want, which is a dozen roses.
You know. And what flowers might have negative meanings?
There aren't any. There's some few. I know that I found some few garden varieties that don't even exist anymore. They've been renamed. There were very few, even in Victorian times, that people just don't use flowers for negativity. Isn't that interesting?
Hmm. And what about flowers with positive domestic meanings that people might want to plant outside their homes?
Things that plant outside their homes, yeah. Chrysanthemums are for prosperity and protection. That's why they're curious. You always see a lot of mums planted outside flowers. Delphinium means love and fun. You want to have a fun household, lighthearted, no drama, plant delphinium in your garden. Larkspur as well stands for levity. You know, I always think you want a home to be cheerful and light. Other popular flowers outside are lilacs. Everybody has lilac bushes, youthful innocence. So yeah, you could literally have your whole garden tell a story or your landscaping outside your house. I don't know of any flowers that actually stand for protection or anything like that. But, you know, it's again, flowers are used for just sweet, loving purposes.
Any other flower meanings that people might want to know?
You know, there's funny ones like gladiolas. What do people think of gladiolas? Funerals. I love them in interiors and just a vase of gladiolas. And it stands for strength of character. So maybe people appreciate them more. Now they know what it stands for. Because people are always afraid of it because they think it means funerals and they only see them at funerals. But there's nothing prettier than a vase of gladiolas in your house. Queen Anne's lace, you see that along the highways in people's backyards. It stands for sanctuary. Daffodils, you could send a guy. He'd say, why the daffodils? Stands for chivalry. And callas for a woman. Callas is a big wedding flower that's been going on lately. And it stands for magnificent beauty. So must be why I'm putting lots of it in wedding bouquets lately.
And you said you brought a poem to finish.
Yes, I brought a poem to read, and it's I found it. It was written in 1875, and it talks about the language of flowers. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
Here it goes. It says, there is a language little known. Lovers claim it as their own. Its symbols, smiles upon the land, wrought by nature's wondrous hand, and in their silent beauty speaks of love and joy to those who seek. For love divine and sunny hours lie in the language of the flowers. So men really relied on these meanings, and you can go back and look up the whole history. I tell your listeners to go back and look at the whole history of these flowers, and some of them you'll have in your garden still. Some of them have been outdated and no longer exist, but decipher your garden. See what's out there, what it means.
Well, Michael Gaffney, thanks for sharing the meaning of flowers, and thanks for being on the
show. Thanks very much. This was fun. I love it. Thanks. Great.
Michael Gaffney started the Milwaukee School of Flower Design. He talked with Lake Effect's Amy Kiley about assembling a symbolic Mother's Day bouquet. A copy of the poem he read and more on flower meanings is at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Roller derby in the Olympics? It could happen. We'll learn more about the boom in derby in the Brew City when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Tomorrow evening at Milwaukee's U.S. Cellular Arena, the Brew City Bruisers will take to the rink for their last home roller derby bout of the season. Roller derby has boomed in recent years in Milwaukee, attracting many more competitors and spectators alike, and even spurring the development of a junior roller derby team. Writer Abby Callard immersed herself in roller derby culture for a recent profile of the Bruisers organization for Milwaukee Magazine, and she is with us to talk more about it. Nice to see you.
It's good to be here.
What drew you to the story of the Brew City Bruisers in the first place?
Well, the Brew City Bruisers have always sort of been something that we've talked about in meetings. You know, Howie, our resident sports guy, has always been really interested in roller derby, and we were kind of trying to figure out a way to cover it. And I went to a film screening, I believe it was this past October, that the Bruce City Bruisers did, and it was of a documentary. And it was more focused on sort of this struggle to be sort of a mainstream, respected sport. A lot of people see roller derby and they see kind of these, you know, these ridiculous stage names and the makeup and the outfits, and they're like, you know, this is just WWF sort of, you know, pro wrestling, not a real sport, and that's really, you know, pretty far from the truth of what it actually is.
You know, I've interviewed a few of the roller derbyists, roller derbyers, participants in the past, and it is still sometimes tough to get a sense for how they view it as a sport, as entertainment, as some kind of hybrid. What? How do people? It's hard to paint them all with the same brush, I'm sure, but how do people view it? Is it a sport on the same level to them as softball or hockey or whatever?
And I think a lot of that stems from sort of the way that the organization is run. I mean, none of, you know, everyone volunteers their time. In fact, the players actually pay to skate. And I think that's part of it. You know, and a lot of the girls have fun wearing the fishnets and the makeup and the names. And, you know, that is a lot of fun. But, you know, make no mistake, these are real athletes and that's how they want to be seen.
Walk us through exactly, I mean, because you, I think, recount in this story some scores from recent bouts and they were scores like the Battle Stars beating the Fox City Scream Puffs 345-86, the Bruisers beating the Appleton Paper Valley Roller Girls 217-150. How do you score points in this sport?
Yeah, so basically, you know, both teams have one jammer on the track, and the jammers have to get through this pack of girls that are trying to knock them on their butts. That's, you know, that's the point. And once you get through once, you have to skate all the way around the track, and then when you get back to this pack, every player on the opposing team that you pass is a point. And so when you see these really, really high scores, that's because these jammers are just getting through these girls and skating around. And, you know, the one score that you mentioned, it was the Battle Stars and the Fox City Scream Puffs. It was kind of an unevenly matched bout, for sure. And that's why, you know, the score, you can kind of see that reflected.
What do you think roller derby has caught on the way it has here? Is there something inherently Milwaukee about this sport?
I'm not sure if there's anything inherently Milwaukee. I guess, you know, for the size of the city that we have, the team is really visible and it has a lot of support. You know, I'm not really sure. It's a good question, though.
I mean, it has grown a lot in recent years. It used to play out in Franklin, is that right?
I think.
And now the bouts or the matches are in the U.S. Cellular Arena. What does game night feel like when you go to the U.S. Cellular Arena and this stuff is actually going on?
Mm-hmm. I think part of the interesting thing is how many different people are there and different types of people that are there. You certainly have, you know, a lot of the families and friends of the skaters, but there's also just families who aren't related that go. So it's a lot of fun to watch. And, you know, they do this ridiculous thing that's kind of based off of the, you know, sausage races at the Brewers, but it's a bottle races. And so there are these girls that are on skates and they have these bottle costumes on and they race around the track. It's just a lot of fun to go and it's loud and it's, I mean, I don't know. The whole theatrics of it plays out a lot in the bouts.
Do you get a sense for what it is that drives the women that take part in this? Are they in it for the physical contact? Are they in it for the exercise? Is it like being on a bowling team?
I mean, I think a lot of it is sort of the empowerment that you get. I mean, it's a violent sport. It's a very physical sport, and it's interesting that it's all women. And I think that that's part of it is that, you know, you're skating with these group of 90 women who all want to do the same thing. And I think there's something really empowering about that, and that's what draws a lot of people to it.
Now, I gather you have actually participated in some level at this.
Yes, some level. I am still trying not to fall on my butt when I skate. I certainly haven't done any hitting or any real playing, but I went to one of the Bruisers boot camps, and there's an exercise thing up in Cedarburg, actually, that's derby light. So it's, you know, the skating without the hitting and the violence.
Do you feel like you have some insight into what it's like on the track, though?
I think so. I mean, when I was reporting for the story, I went to one of the practices or a few of the practices, sorry, and sort of seeing it in that environment is a lot different than seeing it at the U.S. Cellular. You know, when you're sitting up on the stands and you see a hit, that's one thing. But to see it sort of when you're, you know, on the same level and 5 feet away and actually hear everything that's happening it seems a lot more violent there than it does at the U.S. Cellular.
it does look like it hurts.
It does. And I'm sure it does. You know, and a lot of the girls will wear their bruises as like a badge of honor. You know, one of the girls was saying, you know, she had this huge bruise on her shoulder, and instead of trying to cover it up, she wore a sleeveless shirt for 2 weeks to show it off. And that's sort of the mentality that you have to have, I think.
Do you think that the people who do this, do they think they're misunderstood? I mean, you mentioned the image that some people have of roller derby as like professional wrestling on wheels. Is that something that the people who do it are sensitive to?
I mean, it's hard to say. A lot of the girls kind of when they started were drawn by that sort of same aspect, sort of that fun theatrics of it. And then they get into it and realize how intense it actually is. And so I think they want to be respected, but they also want to keep some of those elements, kind of those kitschy, you know, the names again and the fishnets and things like that.
Did you have favorite roller derby names that came to your attention while you were reporting?
I think Milwaukee's Breast is a hilarious name. I mean, there's so many good ones. Super Hera is another good one. And, you know, a lot of the girls kind of will try to play off their own name. And so it's funny if you know their name and the derby name. Some of them are just hilarious. I mean, Grace Kelly is one that's in the story that's really funny, but that it has nothing to do with her real name.
You took part in the boot camp. Did you have to come up with your own name?
I actually did have one from the exercise thing that I was doing, and it was because I wore a pair of shorts from my high school track team that said "Giddy Up" on the butt. So that's what they started calling me, and I was like, "Well, that's good enough."
Anything else about the experience of the Brew City Bruisers or roller derby in Milwaukee that really sticks with you?
I mean, I think the exciting thing is that Milwaukee is sort of an up and coming league, and you know we're holding the WFTDA championships in November, and that's really a huge kind of thing for Milwaukee.
You're going to have to fill in what the WFTDA is for
the
people.
Women's Flat Track Derby Association. So that's sort of the kind of the international regulatory body of flat track roller derby.
And the significance of flat track in the old days in those 1970s roller derby movies and TV shows, mm-hmm. It was a bank track, correct?
Exactly. And there are still some leagues that do the bank track. There's a bunch out in California, I think, that still do it.
So you mentioned the kind of national championship event that's coming up. What do people who do this see as their ultimate aim? I think you're right that nobody's really hoping that this turns into a professional league like the NFL, right?
No. And I, you know, a lot of the girls that I was talking to, they sort of want it to continue to grow. They don't necessarily have a great idea of what sort of the end goal is. You know, one of the things that someone said is that they would like to be covered on the sports page of newspapers as opposed to sort of the lifestyle page. And that was sort of a really interesting kind of idea to me. I mean, being a reporter, that sort of resonates with me. But the other thing is that, you know, I believe in 2020 they're voting for a new sort of Olympic sport, and roller sports, including roller derby, is one of them. It's up for the vote.
Well, that would be something. Abby Callard, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Abby Callard is assistant editor at Milwaukee Magazine. Her article on the Brew City Bruisers is in the May issue. There is a link to it and an accompanying photo gallery from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. The Bruisers' last home meet of the season is tomorrow evening at the U.S. Cellular Arena. One last break, and then an essayist shares the story of the best prom she never had. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Back with more of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. May is prom season for the high schoolers among us. If you are out and about tomorrow evening, you'll probably see many a 17 and 18-year-old dressed to the nines eating dinner in restaurants that don't necessarily serve kids' meals. We all have our prom stories. Mine involves chickening out on asking the high school girl of my dreams and spending the evening eating takeout in a parking lot with another friend who went dateless. Not that that night 26 years ago causes me any lingering regret, mind you. Lake Effect essayist Grace Gunderson also missed her prom a few years back, but she didn't exactly miss out.
My dad raps on my bedroom door and pokes his head inside. I know he means well, and I know he's here to try and make me feel better, but right now I just can't deal with his insistence that my knight in shining armor turned out to be a loser in tinfoil. Today, the day before prom, I got dumped in front of the whole world. Well, the whole lunchroom anyway, and when you're 17, that's close enough. He leans against the door jamb, and I sit up against my headboard. We just stare at each other for a few awful seconds. I'm not a crier, and neither is my dad, so I know enough not to anticipate any full house moments. I'm going to Iowa on Saturday, he says. Come with? I catch my mom's eye from the other room, and we exchange a smirk at what is sure to be another of my dad's harebrained schemes. What will it be this time? World's biggest ball of twine? Anthracite Museum, the Shuffleboard Hall of Fame. My dad is convinced that roadside attractions are the greatest entertainment known to man. But today, he's the first person whose eyes haven't been drowning in sympathy every time he looks at me. And I like that. So against my better judgment, I agree to go with him. Iowa's a long haul from our house, and I'm not exactly turning cartwheels at the prospect of a day-long road trip with the old man. But at the same time, this little impromptu visit could provide me with the perfect excuse to be, well, not here over the weekend. So on the Saturday afternoon of junior prom, while other girls primp in front of mirrors and duck in and out of hair salons, I find myself piling into a Mercury Villager with my father and a couple of peanut butter sandwiches. The ride south is an uneventful one, narrated with Bruce Springsteen CDs and the occasional deer sighting. He doesn't feel the need to tell me where exactly we're headed, and I don't feel the need to ask. Away from here is good enough for me. We go 200 miles on a single stretch of highway, and then turn left. There's a lot of corn and a baseball field. Although I've never been here before, I recognize the set of Field of Dreams immediately. I liked this movie a lot when I was a kid, but I'm not a kid anymore. I know it would be rude to point this out, so I don't. We pull into the gravel parking lot and sit for a long time without really speaking. It strikes me that neither of us particularly wants to be here, yet here we sit. My dad asks if I want to walk around. I shrug, he shrugs, and then we both get out of the car. There's not much to see. It's still early spring, before the days really start to get long, so darkness is falling and the park lights are coming on. Despite what I really think, I tell him it's neat and thank him for something. He grunts and asks me if I want a corn dog. Before long, the mosquitoes are out and the big floodlights start humming, and we're looking at one another like it might be time to go. Before we leave, though, he puts his hands on my shoulders, braced, kind of, like he's trying to keep me from stepping off the field, or from walking away without him, or maybe just from growing up. His mouth opens and closes a few times, like he knows he ought to say something but doesn't know the words. He doesn't find them, I guess, because eventually he drops his arms and we walk back to the car. I know it's one of those moments I'll think about for a long time, always wondering what exactly happened, but never feeling it was right to ask. Although we didn't really say anything, part of me thinks it was the best conversation we've ever had. It's dark by the time we get back on the highway, and I stare out the window and watch headlights pass us by. The car is quiet, save for the ever-present crooning of Bruce Springsteen and the crinkling of cellophane as my dad unwraps a Twinkie. He clears his throat, and with horror I realize I'm not off the hook yet. He says, "I never liked that kid anyway. Always wore the same three shirts." I snort, and it catches in my throat, because God, he did, but it comes out as more of a sob than a laugh, and our eyes meet in the rearview mirror. He sets his hand on mine over the center console without taking his eyes off the road. "Okay," he pats my hand a few times. "Okay." We keep on like that for a long time, both caught, I think, in the sudden realization that this growing up thing is going to be a lot harder than we'd expected. There's already been plenty of growing for one weekend, though, so we defer to a Kenny Rogers duet, and for a few hours at least, the world seems a lot less screwed up. Oh, and prom? It was awesome. At least that's what I heard around school on Monday. I also heard that Tim had been there, with a date. Surprisingly, I didn't really care. I'm glad I spent my prom night on an Iowa interstate with the only boy who would never make me cry.
Grace Gunderson is a soon-to-be senior majoring in creative writing at Beloit College. Gunderson, who is from Savage, Minnesota, has been studying this semester at the University of East Anglia in the UK. That's Friday's Lake Effect, produced by our own Field of Dreams, Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with contributions from Amy Kiley and Eleanor Peterson. John Strelecki is our studio engineer. Whether you are going to prom or celebrating Mother's Day or just taking in a spring weekend, hope you enjoy it. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for letting us be a part of your life, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.